I'm Catherine Barnett, and I'm here to moderate this tribute to Eleanor Ross Taylor. I'll introduce the panelists in a moment. Just wanted to say I woke up yesterday morning in New York City with a line from one of Eleanor Ross Taylor's poems running through my head. It's from To a Young Writer, and I think it came to me because I'd been talking with Jean Valentine, and she, like everyone on this panel, was lamenting how under-recognized Taylor's poems are. She was happy to think that perhaps some younger poets might come to know and appreciate Taylor's work through this tribute. And I see you're all very, very, very young, so that's wonderful. You look great. So I'm going to give you a teeny bit of background about Eleanor Ross Taylor, though probably if you're here, you probably already know about her. Her first book, Wilderness of Ladies, was published in 1960. She was 40 years old. And with each decade, she published another book, and some of those were mostly selections from previous books. So in 1972, she published Welcome Humanities. It was a new and selected poems that came out in 83. Days Going, Days Coming Back, which was new poems and selections, in 1991. Late Leisure in 1999. And only the most recent, which is a collection of new and selected poems, is still in print. Dave Smith, who couldn't be here, is hoping to pull together a new volume. And Eric Gudas is also writing a biography of her. I think that'll be out in a few years. There are a lot of fans of her work who are, I always hear Jean say, like sort of ferociously committed to keeping and getting her work known. In 2010, she was awarded the Poetry Foundation's Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, which is given in recognition of lifetime of extraordinary achievement. So most of you are probably familiar with the outlines of her life. She grew up on a farm in North Carolina in a literary family. She married and had two children with the novelist Peter Taylor. She kept company with the very best American writers of the mid-20th century, writers like Randall Jarrell, Alan Tate, Robert Lowell, Robert Penn Warren, and Elizabeth Bishop were friends or teachers, and sometimes both. Jean will be telling you a little bit about her relationship with Randall Jarrell, that very profound partnership in some ways. Because she did not teach or give many readings, and because of what seems like a temperamental preference for privacy and the unspoken, and because she devoted herself to supporting her husband's career and raising her children, she was, like many of the women she portrays in her poems, an accidental prisoner, that's the title of a poem. A Captive Voice, that's also a title of a poem and also the title of her latest collection. In an interview from 1997, she described her own eddying, quote, "I would write just occasionally," she said, "just the poems that demanded it. Over the years, many times I would say to poems, go away, I don't have time now." Her son, Ross Taylor, in a eulogy he gave for his mother a few weeks ago, described the seemingly contradictory forces at play in his mother. Perhaps, he said, a well-known quote by Flaubert helped to explain her conventional life. This is Flaubert. "Be regular and orderly in your life like a bourgeois, so that you may be violent and original in your work." As a mother, he says, she was lovably predictable. As a writer, all bets were off. In an essay for the Women's Review of Books that Eleanor Ross Taylor wrote in 1999, she described her poems as being, quote, "mostly about people. A number concerned not only personal difficulty as a writer, but the general predicament of frustrated lives, the sense of guilt at not redeeming potential, and frustration at delay of achievement and obscurity." On the other hand, she went on to say, there are advantages for poets who write in the dark, as it were. No pressure to print poor poems or books hastily thrown together because editors, naturally impressed by publicity, ask for them. No dissipation of energy in treks to readings, meetings, writers' conferences. But we're grateful you're all dissipating your energy here today. And we don't think you'll be sorry, because what Eleanor Ross Taylor did write, as you already know or will soon find out, is beautiful and ambitious, full of loneliness, humor, terror, irony, irreverence, and brilliance. I find myself recommending her work to my friends and my students, and return to her work again and again. Or perhaps more accurately, her work returns to me. The line that woke me yesterday morning comes at the end of the poem, after the speaker tells the young writer to, quote, "shop early, get your shots, don't spit, and pass with care. Avoid at all costs death, breakdown, despair." speaker advises, no, keep your chair, tuck your wits in, say finally, I did outdoer them all. The unusual word outdoer seems perfect for both the work and life of Eleanor Ross Taylor. It suggests resilience with its simultaneous acceptance and refusal. It means to outlast, to endure beyond. Eleanor Ross Taylor left us exactly 8 weeks ago at the age of 91. I imagine her still here somehow in the interior, woman singing. It's my honor to introduce these four wonderful poets. Jane Valentine, Kevin Prufer, Ed Skook, and David Wojahn, each of whom has championed the work of Eleanor Ross Taylor. Jean Valentine won the Yale Younger Poets Award for her first book, Dream Barker, in 1965. Her 11th book of poetry is Break the Glass, just out from Copper Canyon last year. Her previous collection, Little Boat, was published by Wesleyan, and Door in the Mountain won the 2004 National Book Award for Poetry. Perhaps most importantly for us, along with her wonderful poems, is the fact that she's the editor of a fantastic collection of essays about Eleanor Ross Taylor called The Lighthouse Keeper, where you can find like Randall Jarrell's Introduction to Wilderness of Ladies and Richard Howard, all these wonderful, Betty Adcock, Ellen Bryant-Voigt, all these wonderful poets speaking about her work. Kevin Prufer will be following Jane, and he's the author of several volumes of poetry, the most recent of which are In a Beautiful Country and National Anthem, both from Four Way Books. National Anthem was named one of the 5 best poetry books of the year by Publishers Weekly. He's also editor of New European Poets and Dunstan Thomas, which is called On the Life and Work of a Lost American Master. He's professor in the Creative Writing Program at the University of Houston. Ed Skook is the author of 2 poetry collections, Mr. Skylight and The Forthcoming Rough Day, both from Copper Canyon. He lives in Seattle. And David Wojahn's most recent collections are Interrogation Palace, New and Selected Poems, which was out in 2006 and which was named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and World Tree. He teaches at Virginia Commonwealth University and in the MFA program of Vermont College of Fine Arts. Before they give their talks, I thought we could listen to, there was an interview done in 2002 with Eleanor Ross Taylor, and I've just taken a moment so you could hear her voice, and she's talking in the clip about the question of originality.
As for being original, I think that every poet in a way is original, because I think that a work of art really reflects the psyche of the artist, and sometimes it's a problem, sometimes it's don't you think a sort of joy or something like that? And oftentimes the artist doesn't really know what it is they're getting rid of in this, or expressing in this poem. They're reaching for understanding, I think, oftentimes, whether they know it or not. And this is what makes them, don't you think, original?
Well, also, before Jean speaks, we'll just listen to her read the poem Where Somebody Died, which is on page 5 in your handout.
Four little limits paid where somebody died. The self refuses to appear in this bare place. It fears that mute chair and the still window. The sunlight scares it. That might rise up a sound. The door doesn't like to move, and the crow out there hesitates. He knows a hole flung into by mistake would make a bite of him. What was sits there still in the chair, hangs stunned against the dry-eyed light. Nobody in sight, inanimate things, still lifeless. This room so empty, I doubt I'm standing here. There can't be room for me in total emptiness. Only some far-off sounds persist, the brute truck over the interstate, the flames in the incinerator chewing his old vest.
I'd like to thank all of you, especially Catherine, for gathering us today and thinking of Eleanor together and hearing her work. I want to particularly thank Mary Flynn. So many times I'd go down often to as far as Richmond and to see Eleanor, and then Mary would drive me over and go about her visits with other people and then come and bring me back. And it was so good of you. Thank you. and for many, many other things. And thanks to Dave Smith. I'm sorry he can't be here. He published her throughout his life, and he will continue, I think. So we're very lucky. Nobody deserves as many thanks as Randall Jarrell. Some of you probably might not know that, but I'll talk about that for a minute, because I think you said I would. He was a friend of Peter's and then met Eleanor, and it's funny now that a woman wouldn't publish a book till she's 40, but it wasn't funny then. There were very few women poets who we knew about, and she was very, very lucky to fall in, and he was even luckier, you know, to find her, and she was very lucky because he championed her work. He sent it out to magazines, he got the book published, he wrote the introduction, which is a brilliant. I wish I could just stand here and read you his introduction today, but they don't let you. I don't mean you, but it's life doesn't let you. I wanted to read you one thing he said, which was, "Are you writing?" And she'd say, "No." And he'd say, "You'll be sorry. God will make you sorry." So he was very, very important. And Catherine said I should say something about knowing her a little bit. And one thing I said to her once was, "Do you think that the first person who ever really loves your poetry, you kind of fall in love with?" And I thought, am I going too far here, you know? But she said, "Oh, I think it's obligatory." So that was wonderful. Well, I'd like to read two poems which I think cast light on each other. They're similar in their sense of being captive, and you have them in your handouts, and in their gut knowledge of being free. They have a sense of being called by poetry, and the sense, too, of maybe not being caught up to it. Maybe they should save the gift for later, or maybe it will abandon them. So the first one I'll read is by Emily Dickinson, who seems to be here with us in Chicago. Have you noticed? She's everywhere. I'm so glad. So she's here too. I'm going to read a poem which I've never understood and which I finally made peace with myself about a year ago about not understanding, and I thought maybe she didn't understand it either. It has a sort of last four lines or a sort of koan or a riddle, I think, and then I think she accepted it. But what do I know? But I'll read it to you anyway. It's on your thing. We could read it together. You want to? Let's read Dickinson together.
Okay.
All right. My life had stood a loaded gun in corners till a day the owner passed, identified, and carried me away. And now we roam in sovereign woods, and now we hunt the doe. And every time I speak for him, the mountains straight reply. And do I smile, such cordial light, upon the valley glow? It is as a Vesuvian face had let its pleasures through. And when at night, our good day done, I guard my master's head, 'tis better than the eider duck's deep pillow to have shared. To foe of his, I'm deadly foe, none stir the second time, on whom I lay a yellow eye or an emphatic thumb. Though I than he may longer live, he longer must than I, for I have but the power to kill without the power to die." So I'll just go to thank you. I loved hearing all your voices. I'd like to just go to Eleanor's poem, At the Altar. You have that too. "That bag you packed me when you sent me to the universe. Camp after camp, I've opened it, debating whether to unpack. Not yet, not yet. Why did I feel so much in it was dangerous on the playground, too good for every day? Feel those splendid fireworks hazardous to institutions, unmannerly to etiquette, so that time after time I found myself saying, not yet. At each new place I faced it, it suggested, here, spread out your things, put on this coat, open this bottle. No, not yet." sometimes throwing something out, giving things away, lightening my load. The more I pull out, the more it seems some days is left inside, the heavier it is. Sometimes I think this package is almost a door, the opening of which, careening across heaven, could be fatal. Some days now I wonder if I'll ever dare face my given garments, permanently wrinkled, surely out of date. Your travel thought, wasting in its tissue, flesh corrupt, till I've absorbed it, like those stitches that dissolve in an incision where something's been removed. Captivity. Jurel said in his brilliant introduction to Taylor's first book, A Wilderness to Ladies, which Catherine has mentioned, the world is a cage for women, and inside it, the woman is her own cage. Captivity seems general in our world today, and we can be thankful for Eleanor Taylor welcoming captivity as her muse. One way out is our dreams, and I will finish with a dream poem of Taylor's that I love for its oddness. It's called Contemplating Jailbreak. Through the bars, surrender, saw my music, scissors, my embroidery. I was making masks for a rabbit, using the bag the river came in, a few holes. Marriage was an economy all round. How I got here, halt, four corners, halt again. That's another story. The judge would not lean down, but my testimony is, he swore, I'll come throw the moon over your shoulder every night. Pay me when you can. After that, nights were scarce, ones frequent, halt, doing time. However, finally, I didn't want September days longer. A length of chiffon slithering over drab pines, just what I can't use. Somehow, too, had fallen in love with that mink sitting above December on some snow. A treatise, save your skin. However, some coats, designated goods, the spot lit, hit me. I thought how well it was arranged, the magic carpet bedside, the turbaned engineer. Get on. A dream to take us miles away. The letter flap was folded back. I sealed the pillow. My testimony is, in the beginning, my bed had little round china rolling feet. That's why.
Funny, I was also drawn to think about Emily Dickinson when I was thinking about her poems. What drew me first to Eleanor Ross Taylor was the sort of wicked wit that goes on the surfaces of so many of these. But one of the things I've learned to admire most in the work of certain poets, Stevie Smith, Robert Frost, and Frederick Seidel, and Eleanor Ross Taylor, first among them right now, is when it seems to me that the summarizable meaning of a poem has an uneasy relationship with the music of the poem. Or put another way, I believe that the technical choices a poet makes, where she breaks a line or how she employs rhyme, what sort of rhythms work through her poems, have articulatable and describable meaning. But when the musical meaning of a poem veers strikingly away from what I think of as the literal meaning of a poem, I'm especially interested. And it's of this that Eleanor Ross Taylor has always seemed to me to be a master, especially in her many poems in which the specter of death comes up against the colloquial and the plain-spoken and seemingly upbeat narrators. Put another way, in many of my favorites of her poems, Taylor achieves an unlikely and uneasy marriage of function and form. She is expert at manipulating the voices of an easy-going, storytelling elderly woman or a chain gang guard or a young mother. Hers are so often familiar-seeming voices, generally laced through with unexpected rhyme, quick rhythms, moments of hesitant caesura and surprising line breaks serving to underscore a shiftiness of mind a hesitance, a tendency to revise thinking and to undercut whatever it was she was saying just a moment ago. And it's easy to be lost in all this complexity and color, but beneath it, down in her speaker's anxious and sometimes devious minds, something much darker and stranger is sometimes happening. The mind that on the surface seemed sprightly goes to eerie and often mortal places, places that mind can't itself sometimes quite articulate. I recently had an uncanny accidental moment encountering a very early and a very late Taylor poem side by side. The first of these was published in her debut volume and seems to bury a terrifying question about mortality in the sugar of an old man's memories of childhood. The very last poem in her last book answers the very question that the early poem seemed to me to ask. The speaker in song, who I take to be a grandfather, a rarity in her work, the only other male character I can find is the speaker I can find is in the chain gang guard, is chatting with young children, perhaps his own grandchildren. He's a strange, mortality-obsessed, and even morbid sort of type. Like others of Taylor's speakers, he can't bring up the subject of marriage without also bringing up death. He marks his marriage by when his pa died, then tells us his wedding reminded me of the funeral. Apparently free associating, he talks briefly about discovering a body in a field when he was a child, a dark man, a foreigner-like, only to brag about how he and his discovery appeared in the newspaper, a clipping he has kept all these years. He then turns this deep, to my mind, sort of hilarious morbidity on himself and his grandchildren, meditating on all their own deathly swole-up faces before imagining what it must be like to be dead and utterly forgotten. All these details would be astonishing and unnerving, but perhaps a little arbitrary, were it not for two things. The first is musical, the superficially inappropriate skitteriness of the rhythm that runs through this poem and the frequent clanging of rhymes in surprising places. All these transform the speaker of this poem from sadness or resignation to something entirely else. The poem's music suggesting a sort of grinning skullishness, or more even than this, the double-mindedness of the speaker who can't face the prospect of death and erasure without coming at it slantwise, through memories, stories, a jaunty, revealing narrative that slowly breaks down until at the poem's end, he speaks in unpunctuated, uneasy, detonation-like assertions. Secondly, the poem is threaded together with a single Emily Dickinson-like metaphor, a bucket hanging from a rope in the bottom of a dark well, a bucket that seems finally to represent the consciousness of the speaker alone in his knowledge of his own unavoidable death, a speaker who finally imagines the rope breaking, the bucket bobbing around in the black water. Who, he asks at the end, imagining his isolation in non-existence, will ever hear a sound? There's something rhetorical about this question. Ultimately, of course, the answer is no one will hear from you when you're dead. Eventually, all of our ropes break and all of us are forgotten. But put another way, the question is heartfelt and perhaps answerable. Perhaps our families, even the family of this morbid, complex, and I think kind of unpleasant person, will hear us. And perhaps the question offers some hope for the divine, some rescue from deathly emptiness, though maybe I'm kidding myself here. I'm going to read the poem. It's called Song. Oh, my dearie. Our childhoods are histories, buckets at the bottom of the well, and hard to tell whether they will hold water or no. Did Pa die before we were married? No, he died in 27, but I remember the wedding reminded me of the funeral. When grandbabies ask, little do they care, I will tell them about the man I found that day at my plowing in the low grounds lying at the edge of the water. His face had bathed 5 nights, a dark man, a foreigner-like. They never found his kin to tell. Buckets, buckets at the bottom of the well. It was in the paper with my name. I found him. I have the clipping, tells all about it if your grandma ain't thrown it out. Oh, my dearie, when our faces are swole up, we will look strange to them. Nobody looking out the door will think to call us in. They'll snap their fingers trying to recollect our names. 5 nights, 5 bones, 5 buckets, who will ever hear a sound? Oh, my dearie, the rope broke. The bucket bobs round. Oh, my dearie. The very last poem in Eleanor Ross Taylor's last book is Ancestral, another one about death and family, another poem laced through with a wit, a tight rhyme, a clever nod to Dickinson, all of these complicating a deeper anxiety about mortality. But here, Taylor reverses the situation of the early poem, answering its question from the position of someone watching what seems to be a funeral cortege, thinking about her own ancestors, those old unknowns who went ahead, tracked previous blood, and can't turn back as if they would. As they fade into the very oblivion the speaker in song feared for herself. what the poem seems to ask can we do about our mortality, our uncertain fate in the afterlife, if indeed there ever was one, but grin at it and nod resignedly? The dead are unreachable, and the answer to the early poem's question, who will ever hear a sound, is no one. But given that, we might as well have fun and joke around a bit. We can't catch up to say a word, she writes. Far down the line, the traffic's slow, but yes, we'll follow. Can't say no. Of course, the word follow here has a double meaning, that will literally follow the procession down the road, and more urgently, eventually follow the deceased into death. Or put another way, the breeziness of this poem offers, if not comfort, then at least an answer to the question the character of the previous poem, for all the shiftiness, couldn't answer. Ancestral. Of course we'll follow. Did you say horse or hearse? No matter. They're far ahead. They started early. Shoe buckles, stovepipe hats. What's triter than hooves clatter? Is dead silence worse? Can't time think anything but fly and still won't give us fair goodbye? Did you say horse or hearse? We listen. No, no calling back. We'll follow, yes, see petals shatter, and wheels roll over them, no matter. Bone of our bone, those old unknowns who went ahead, tracked previous blood, and can't turn back as if they would. We can't catch up to say a word. Far down the line, and traffic slow, but yes, we'll follow, can't say no. Of course, I have had 10 to 15 minutes to say something about what I have admired in Eleanor Ross Taylor, and that can't really suffice. Her strange, witty, colloquial poems have taught me much more than just this, but if I could sum it all up, what she has shown me about poetry and what is visible in this unlikely pair of early and late poems is how we might make use of diction, persona, rhythm, and rhyme, not to complicate meaning, but to suggest through counterpoint something of the complexity of our most difficult questions and our most ardent fears, and that these might be portrayed most effectively not with fireworks and bombast, but in what seems at first to be delicate, familiar, and simple. I do not know why Taylor has not been ranked among the greatest poets of the second half of the 20th century, among the likes of Bishop or Ashbery or Merwin and etc. Perhaps because she wasn't prolific and didn't engage much in criticism, didn't travel around doing readings, perhaps it has been easy for critics to ignore work that so often resides, at least superficially, in the Southern, the life of the home, the speech of everyday people, particularly women. Perhaps because the narrative, the colloquial, slippery, plain-spokenness of her poems is out of fashion these days, but I am certain that before too long, more of us will be reading her work closely. Her voice is, I believe, ambitious and brilliant and strange enough to be of lasting and growing importance.
Hi, I'm Ed Skoog. I did not know Eleanor Ross Taylor. I came to her work through being a big fan of Peter Taylor, short stories and novels, and through conversation with Joe DeSalvo, who runs a bookstore in New Orleans. He enlightened me to the significant thing about Peter Taylor, which is that he was her husband. And like, you know, Jean Stafford and Robert Lowell, who she knew well, I think in the long term it may be Jean Stafford who we're reading in 50 years rather than Lowell. No disrespect to Lowell and Peter Taylor, I think that Eleanor Ross Taylor's work may outlast his as really representing its time as very well. And what that generation had in common, fiction writers and poets, I think, perhaps taking the cue from Dickinson, was a really distinct precision of diction. The right word, of course, which all writers shoot for, less so today. The thing that Dickinson does of, you feel the mind and the imagination searching for the right word and then going just to the side of it, so that these ambiguities and these complexities and perplexities widen up so that you can read them infinitely. I wanted to talk about one poem, Late Leisure, which is in your handout. This was the last poem in her collection, Late Leisure, from 1999. And bookends the volume, with the first poem being The Long-Dreaded Event. All of her books are books of mourning and grieving in a way, this one particularly. It was originally published in Parnassus. It's about an embroidery kit. The speaker is working on an embroidery sampler, which you don't know, if you don't know what that is, would be an embroidery that's not a specific representational scene or portrait. It would be fabric in which the embroiderer is doing needlework for practice, for skill, for demonstration, to learn some other project that they then might incorporate in some other thing, and to try out a pattern that they found someone else doing. And a kit, so you know, something you would buy or borrow, and work your way through like a puzzle, but it would be like a notebook or a sketchbook for an embroiderer. Late leisure. Some things achieve finale. Vivace tu larghetto. 300 pages, end. 310, of course, that's it. But this embroidery that I inch aimlessly along could be found years from now, wadded, unfinished in a basket. I, past my expiration date, fold the cloth twice for center, my needle threaded for the first small stitch, myself capriciously ongoing. I see it as a sampler challenging. It has a long, protracted feel. The dog each morning barking at the gate, just where I left him yesterday. I'll flesh out by the millimeter a gawky shepherdess, a time-lapse federal house beyond, odd birds and fish to signify, earth floundering on. The alphabet that's used for English, French, Italian, more tongues than I will speak in this life, but fewer than bird calls I recognize. I'll work through color changes almost photosynthetic. I'll search out chairs by windows in south-facing rooms. I'll never work by artificial light. The sun won't cast the shadow of these men. The curly beasts submit to cubist life as in some static dream, the dead dream in their sleep, some plastic intervention. If I get to the last rows of this kit, I'll have to find another one as slow and interim, but no need to plan that yet. I adore this poem for the many things that it does. I adore it for doing what I adore a lot of her work for, which I find as a writer trying to develop and find some way to contend with being an adult, somebody willing to speak honestly about being an adult, which is a role that poets are free to abdicate and generally do. But I like what I find in her, something like in Edward Arlington Robinson, what a critic called the evening voice, E-A-R, that evening voice. And I hear that evening voice in her work, that maturity that is earned and not turned away from, but confronted, but with humor. The last line of this poem, which then is the last line of a very heavy book. You know, notice these five-line stanzas, and then it's curtailed. It's four. It's a little joke on itself. It shrugs it off, sort of, as Kevin was saying. The appearance of simplicity with bottomless depths. Late leisure. But it begins casting itself, I think, in the realm, and I would put this poem in the same room with Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn and Yeats's Sailing to Byzantium as magnificent investigations of age and art and mortality. But it starts out comparing, you know, some things. Again, like the last line, a little bit of a, you know, a soft beginning, some things. And then Vivace tu larghetto, fast to slow, like the Mahler concerto, or a 300-page novel, or 310, right, which is from Psalm 90, verse 10, the days on earth that we are allotted, after which, if you have more, you eventually fly away. And then that simple, casual, that's it, the colloquial, that's it. But then the coordinating conjunction, which is a little deceptive, but this embroidery, unlike all of those other things, which are hard to put in one category, music, novels, and a life, I inch aimlessly along could be found years from now, wadded unfinished in a basket, which means so many different things. At first, perhaps, life is short, art is long. Right? Unlike those things, this embroidery will last, although it will be perhaps discarded, perhaps unfinished because She says, I'm aimless, I'm capricious, I might just discontinue it and water up and throw it away, or, you know, that her 3 score and 10 might arrive before she finishes it. And inside that, some of the purpose of this panel, and hopefully future scholarship and readership, this work will be found later. But this other thing in the nature of a sampler, that it's an unfinishable thing, can't be finished, because there's always some other little pattern, some other object, some other little bird, some other alphabet letter to throw in. And then she compares herself to it. I, an expiration, past my expiration date. And then the details, and then the magical, find myself capriciously ongoing. Capricious. You know this word, capricious? Capo, the head. Riccio, hedgehog in Italian. The head of a hedgehog, which is spiky. And originally meant in Italian, somebody who's been frightened. But then through an aimless and capricious act, in gets mistaken for capra, which is goat. And so it becomes like a whim. And that sort of ongoing. So I hear this capricious ongoingness, sort of an animal sort of ongoingness, the aimlessness of the body, the hedgehog, the goat, all of in that going forward, both of her as an embroiderer, her as a poet, her as a person on earth, and the poem. It has a long protracted feel. In that fifth stanza, there's a little self-portrait of the gawky shepherdess and all of these images, which makes me think of the shield of Achilles, which is, this sampler contains an impossible number of things. It contains all the things of the earth. It contains the alphabet, which may be used in all these different languages, including the 3 languages that lead up to the word capricious, French, Italian, and English. She seems to know it. Then moves through to the color changes, almost photosynthetic, a sophisticated gesture of, you know, the pigment that contains energy, that draws energy. The works on the embroidery, this poem, are coming to life in a way as the speaker feels herself, or feels like she ought to be dimming, although she doesn't seem to be, seems to be resisting it. And that last, that move from that, this long chain of things that she'll do on the embroidery to where she'll work on it, only in south-facing rooms. I'll never work by artificial light, and the aesthetic implied in that, which is so strong. And this last stanza, if I get to the last rose of this kit, sort of abandoning any coyness about that she's not talking about poetry and her life. Once out of this body, I will never choose, I'll have to find another one as slow and interim, an unusual choice, a devastating choice in my reading of it. And then after taking us to that brink, shrugs it off, but no need for that yet. That honesty and that craft we find so very rarely that needs very much to be treasured, and I encourage you all to foist her work on at least 5 people in the next year. That's my challenge to you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with us too.
Thank you all for being here. This is a bittersweet event because it was going to be a celebration of Eleanor Ross Taylor, and now it's a different sort of ceremony. I'm just very honored to be talking about Taylor and also to be with these panelists. And since they daunt me so much, I wrote something. In the so-called dark, the strange domesticity of Eleanor Ross Taylor. Here's a poem which appears near the end of Eleanor Ross Taylor's 1999 collection, Late Leisure, published on the eve of the poet's 80th birthday. That's on your handout. It's called Skywalker. Prowlers have scared the stars away. She sets her outside light for 6. Her neighbor burns his all night, every night. The city sends a van with a lift basket and a man to change street bulbs by schedule. Some mornings, in the so-called dark, she gives up searching Venus between chimneys and massed leaves, turns out the lamps and sits with all the shades in the living room. Vast frames of light hang on the walls. Umbrella and cane handles rise, gibbous in expanses unexplained. She watches the fluorescent rays from kitchen louvers crosshatch bookshelves, emitting black dimensions stygian and pure. A chair projects a symbol malformed on the floor, and Bernice's hair, blowing somewhere, showers her human arm. The Sky Watcher is a quintessential lyric from Taylor's late period. It is a kind of Manichaean abode. Its preoccupations are at once celestial and domestic, otherworldly and quotidian. And while the poem sets itself firmly within the realm of the everyday, a place of porch lights left on to ward off burglars and peeping toms, of bookshelves, umbrellas, and living room chairs, it also enacts an epic struggle between the forces of dark and the forces of light, and unhesitatingly acknowledges that the forces of darkness will invariably prevail. But not yet, at least not for another day. In this respect, the poem is uncannily similar to Philip Larkin's magisterial late lyric, Abode. In both poems, the insomnia that so often accompanies old age becomes the occasion for a terrifying reckoning with mortality, a confrontation with what Larkin's poem grimly labels a special way of being afraid no trick can dispel. Yet Taylor's treatment of this struggle is altogether stranger, quirkier, and more nuanced than Larkin's gruff recasting of the stiff upper lip posturing that so epitomizes British culture in general and Larkin's poetry in particular. Indeed, the close of The Sky Watcher is oddly bracing. Taylor's protagonist seems to revel in the liminal, and I would go as far as to say visionary, moments when darkness and light grow indistinguishable. It is a time of consummate defamiliarization. The gibbous cane handles, the fluorescent rays from kitchen louvers that crosshatch bookshelves emitting black dimensions stygian and pure. The malformed symbol of the chair. Taylor's visionary moment is fraught with paradox. Stygian purity is a term one might find in the work of the metaphysical poets. Henry Vaughan's The Dawning, for example, characterizes the end of the night in much the same fashion. Indeed, it is the only time that with thy glory doth best chime. In the poem's final lines, the protagonist finds herself rinsed in starlight. But here, too, the ecstatic moment comes with a caveat. Few of us could identify the constellation known as Bernice's Hair, and it is the only constellation in the night sky named for an actual historical figure. One of the Ptolemies, an avid astronomer, named a cluster of unusually bright stars within the constellation of Leo after his wife, Bernice. It is thus the only domestic constellation. How fitting an allusion to be employed by a poet whose abiding subjects are domesticity and enclosure, and whose central project in the lyrics of late leisure is to address the intricate factorials of grief. The poems are suffused with mourning, addressing above all the loss of the poet's longtime husband, fiction writer Peter Taylor. The title of the book's opening poems makes this subject abundantly clear. The long dread event takes place. As Laurie Goldenshawn has written of this volume, everywhere in these poems, the just dead, long dead, soon to be dead, leave their ringing mark. The days of the living, the sometimes dubious gift of all those coming before and those coming after, well, the tug of their debt to us still to be measured. Yet at the same time, the poems celebrate, sometimes giddily, sometimes guiltily, the ferocious unleashing of creative power that is the consequence of the long dread event. Although I think Taylor sells herself short when she confesses in an interview that she was never serious about her work until she entered her 70s, the poems of late leisure and the smattering of new work that is included in her 2008 selected volume, Captive Voices, puts Taylor in the company of that small but august group of poets who find their characteristic voices fairly early in their career, but wrote their work of greatest consequence towards the end of exceptionally long lives. I think of Thomas Hardy, Robert Penn Warren, Czesław Miłosz, Stanley Kunitz, among others. All of these figures on this list are primarily elegiac poets, and perhaps because they are all poets who wrote their best work in old age, they remind us that no one is an elegist by choice. Many of the most affecting elegiac reckonings occur when grief is reawakened without warning in an everyday event, a moment of heartbreak that helplessly recalls the lost beloved. Here is Hardy hallucinating the voice of his late wife. "Can it be that I hear you? Let me view you then, standing as I drew near to the town, where you would wait for me. Yes, I knew you then, even to the original air blue gown." Here is Miłosz in a poem entitled Apricots. "Apricots, the whole tree full of them, and the dark leaves glimmer, yellow and red, bringing to mind the Garden of Hesperides and apples of paradise. I reach for the fruit and suddenly feel the presence and put aside the basket and say, it's a pity that you died and cannot see these apricots while I celebrate undeserved life." The beloved persists, arriving to startle or haunt within the rituals of the everyday. And as often as not, it is through enfetishment that the dead are preserved. Hardy's recollection of the air blue gown is a form of memento mori, the verbal equivalent of the strands of hair of dead loved ones that his fellow Victorians would so tenderly and ghoulishly preserve in lockets. But such memorials, be they physical or poetic, are themselves ephemeral. Cradling a photo of his dead father, Rilke famously laments, "Oh, quickly disappearing photograph, in my more slowly disappearing hands." This is a terrifying revelation, and yet for the elderly, such events can occur with benumbing regularity. This is the subject of a second Taylor poem I would like to briefly discuss, one of the new poems in Captive Voices. It is altogether more pitiless than The Sky Watcher. This is Where Somebody Died. "The self refuses to appear in this bare place. It fears the mute chair and the still window. The sunlight scares it. There might rise up a sound. The door doesn't like to move, and the crow out there hesitates. He knows a hole flown into by mistake would make a bite out of him. What hangs standstill in the chair hangs, stunned against the dry-eyed light. Nobody in sight. Inanimate things, still lifeless. The room's so empty, I doubt I'm standing there. There can't be room for me in total emptiness. Only some far-off sounds persist. The brute truck over the interstate. The flames in the incinerator, chewing his old vest." And I couldn't believe when I heard the poem a few minutes ago that when I read it, it sounds so sad. And when she reads it, it sounds so funny. But it is something of an injustice to subject a poem as limpid and brutally abject as this to any sort of analysis. The sheer palpability of grief that informs the poem is quite near overwhelming. This is due in no small measure to the fact that the poem is not about the death of the person who is mourned, but the place of death. A familiar locale now imbued with a singular, unsettling foreignness, a place where the departed is gone, but objects have been eerily personified, a door that doesn't like to move, a mute chair, and the past itself is personified. It sits standstill in a chair. Standstill being an oddball Hopkinsian play on words of the sort we find often in Taylor's late work. We are given a description of an interior where objects are peculiarly animate, but at the same time it is a place utterly lifeless and desolate. I'm reminded of those lines in Stevens' The Plain Sense of Things, another poem about domestic ruination. It is as if we had come to the end of the imagination. It is a locale that is now so alien, the speaker herself seems unable to inhabit it, however familiar the terrain. The self refuses to appear in this bare place. Yet it is the self Taylor evokes. Yet is the self Taylor evokes the speaker of the poem, or is it the somebody who died? Clearly, for Taylor as a fastidiously precise writer, this ambiguity is willful. When a first-person speaker does emerge, nothing self-revelatory or consoling accompanies her appearance. I doubt I'm standing here. There can't be room for me in total emptiness. However, and this seems to me what causes the poem to be quietly triumphant, the closing of the poem shifts focus. We leave the standstill place of death for a world that offers no comfort, and yet, as in the case of the Skywatcher, the closing lines of the poem suggest a guarded epiphany. Only some far-off sounds persist, the brute truck over the interstate, the flames of the incinerator chewing his old vests. Terrifying as these final images may be, they make a stark contrast to the metaphors of oppression, inertia, and delimitation that characterized the previous lines of the poem. The final images are a stunning tour de force, sharply visual, but also kinesthetic, even synesthetic. We both see and hear the flames as they chew upon the dead beloved's vests. And thus the departed is countenanced, brought forth at last as the memory of a living presence, if only for an instant, as the flames do their work. It is Taylor's homespun version of a Viking funeral, with the vests, not the longboat, blazing to ash in their own majestic conflagration. With the passing of Eleanor Ross Taylor this year, literature lost one of the very last surviving members of what has come to be known as the middle generation of American poets, that astonishing and troubled company of Lowell, Bishop, Berryman, Ruthke, Oppen, Rukeyser, Nidecker, and Taylor's cherished mentor, Randall Jarrell. What these writers shared above all was an uncompromising fidelity to their craft and a relentless desire to fuse the personal with the social, public history with private. Ultimately, it matters little whether these writers sought to achieve such end on a grand scale, as in Lowell, or on a more seemingly modest scale, as with Eleanor Ross Taylor. And sadly, Taylor's death also leads me to reluctantly suspect that poets of this particular and abiding ambition are unlikely to rise again. Thank you.
We're not going to take questions, but we'll be very happy to have anybody come up and continue the conversation here. And I will just play two poems, one very, very short one at the very end. So we end with On Her Voice, which I think is a beautiful way to end this wonderful celebration and tribute.
Kitchen table, limit, pain in the house. Feeling her head pick up her body, question mark. Blurred, misstamped question marks, legs out of bed, trying to jiggle unhappiness as little as possible, not to wake pain, not to raise a shade, if raising a shade in the dark wakes pain. Under the shade, the stars are awake, smiling, ready to frown on unhappiness. And the happiness of the unconscious is scurrying already from the knife edge of light, pain's nightlight, waiting under the door across the hall. Dreads, square hair stiffens, her feet have corners, trying to trick the stairs out of their creaking and the house out of groaning before coffin, before resurrection. Death before resurrection is hard. Breakfast and the stars belong first. Plenty of time to die all day when everything does groan and unhappiness shakes itself out like a musty old mare all over the house. Dread says to herself, serves me right for leaving home, for learning to read, serves me right for children and menopause and cosmetic surgery and elation and gym. I must travel back through the shade and the black holes and the frowns, through drink and tampon and alphabet, to the kitchen and mother and dad and the morning of the resurrection was the first day. Pain, limit, kitchen paper. Before I lived with a knife and found it hard, for years took nicks and scratches, not to mention cuts. She who took tedium by the ears, non-forthcoming pickles, defiant stretched out lettuce, soft good particles. He who came down whack, his conversation even itched. Lying beside him in the drawer, she formed a crazy patina. The season stacked, melons succeeded by cured pork. He dulled, he was a dull knife, while she was, after all, a fork.